Hello, and welcome to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are reading Deborah Marquardt's The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We are rejoining the narrative as Deborah is talking about having sent a copy of the first book of poems that she had published to her parents, and she is worried about how one of the poems, which describes a rebellious teenager's reaction and anger toward her mother, will be received by her parents. I'll back up to the beginning of the paragraph. Before I shipped the book off to them, I considered cutting "I am upstairs trying to be quiet" from the collection with a razor blade, excising it so cleanly that its absence would not be noticed. But I quickly found that removing the offending poem meant that the second page of Motorcade, my poem about the Kennedy assassination, would go with it, which meant that I would have to take the first page of Motorcade too, and then I'd have to eliminate the last half, and then all of another poem, and so on and so on. In total, I found I would need to extract 9 pages from the book, a gap so flagrant in a slim volume of poetry that even my parents would have noticed. My sister Elizabeth, who is also an artist, finally calmed my fears, assuring me that our parents would never read the book because they'd be too grossed out by the cover, which featured a surreal Peter Dean painting of 3 women emerging out of the water with their pink nipples glistening. Her predictions had proved accurate. So far, I'd heard no mention of the book, not on the 12-hour drive to Montana, not during the 2 days at my sister's house in Bozeman. Instead, my mother chattered about her cleaning job at the Catholic Church. The monotony of travel, it seems, put all our mouths on an endless tape loop, like some Muzak version of small talk. We repeated to each other hourly the 5 or 6 things we knew for certain. On the way home, my mother became fixated on the evergreens, the way they grew straight out the side of the mountain. She repeated this observation several times, and I agreed with her each time, answering with a light, "uh-huh," all the while monitoring her voice for tone, waiting for that slight inflection that indicated she might veer off into anger or disapproval about the poems in my book. 2 hours to Miles City," I whispered into my shirt sleeve as we passed the industrial smokestacks that mark the outskirts of Billings. By nightfall, I would have them safely home. To pass the time, I imagined my burgundy-colored van with all its fluid levels topped off and ready to go, sitting in my parents' driveway, patiently anticipating my return so that I could hop in, turn the key, point its nose southeast, and never look back. It was 10 in the morning. My eyes were already drowsy with sleep, but I refused to yield the wheel. I cracked the window open for fresh air and popped myself on the side of the head a few times to wake up. My mother sat in the passenger seat with her white purse tucked neatly under her legs. She reached down every few minutes, I noticed, and touched it with her fingertips to make sure it was still there. Once we cleared Billings and the land started to level off, I pressed down hard on the accelerator, set the cruise to 80, and pushed into the open road, letting the Oldsmobile swallow up miles. I saw the deer a second before we were upon her, time enough to tap the brake and release the cruise, but not long enough to warn my passengers or slow the car. In a field to the right, sunlight reflected off a shallow creek. Perhaps she had sheltered there the night before, in the small stand of trees winding along the waterline. She moved through the green, the grass thick and high around her, and then she stepped delicately through the opening and onto the pavement. There she hovered in the emergency lane, with her tail end toward us. She seemed to be taking in the day, the cool velvet of her nose sniffing out the crisp morning air. Later I would recall how she looked to her right first, to the open field where the creek flowed lightly over rocks. Then she looked to her left, to the twin lanes of worn pavement. For a second she twisted her neck to look behind her, staring down the road to where our car was screaming toward her. "Don't do it," I thought. She seemed to look straight at me. I gripped the wheel. I only needed her to stay inches outside the right lane. Her eyes were black and luminous and filled with a kind of dew. "Don't even think about it," I said. She swayed to the right for a moment, to that endless rolling prairie that waited beyond the ditch. Then she turned and stepped left into the driving lane, the tawny brown of her body growing large in the windshield, meeting with the powerful front bumper of the Oldsmobile. The hood crumpled up, pieces of fiberglass flying to the side as we pushed through. Her body lifted up, then glanced off across the left lane, finally coming to land in the grassy median between the east and westbound lanes. A group of cars rushed by as we slowed, their tires crushing debris and scattering our chrome and fiberglass down the road and into the ditches. Feeling the front end wobble, I tapped the brakes and angled the car into the emergency lane. My mother put her hand on the dashboard. My father sat forward in the back seat as we inched to a halt, the radiator already blowing a thin plume of steam. Everything in the car was silent for a moment. My first thought was of my father. Would his heart survive this? I glanced at him in the rearview mirror. He was sitting up, breathing easily, more alert than I'd seen him in days. He caught my eyes in the corner of the mirror. "Are you okay?" I said to his reflection. He nodded yes, with a stunned expression, as if to say, "That was some ride." "I didn't even see it coming," he said. "I knew it," my mother said from the passenger seat in a wavering voice, her fists in her lap. "I knew we shouldn't have left home." "Are you hurt, Violet?" my dad said to her, putting his hand on the front seat headrest. "Oh," she moaned, "I just had a feeling something bad was going to happen." She rocked in her seat and clutched at her pant legs. "Are you okay?" I repeated, studying her now. Physically, she appeared unhurt. "My car!" She began to cry, putting her face in her hands and rocking her shoulders. "My nice car!" "Oh, Mom," I said, thinking about all the other ways this accident might have turned out. "That can be fixed." I put the car in park and turned off the ignition. "The most important thing," I reminded her, "is that we're all okay."
"But I bought this car with my own money," she cried. "It was the only new car I ever owned."
"Oh, Violet," my dad said from the back seat, "we'll get it fixed."
"No, we won't," she said, pointing to the steam that was bubbling up under the crumpled hood and rising in a thin wisp from the radiator. "It'll never be the same."
Her hand shook as she undid her seatbelt and grabbed her purse off the floor. Outside, cars were whizzing by without even slowing down or changing lanes.
"How are we going to get home?"
Her voice sounded lost and childlike. She pulled on the door handle, and the passenger door cracked open, letting in a rush of wind as cars roared past. "We'll figure it out," I said. I had no doubt we would. For 7 years I had been a road musician, touring in old buses, trucks, and vans on a less-than-zero budget. I'd found my way through more rollovers, accidents, and roadside breakdowns by the age of 25 than most people experienced in a lifetime. And that was before car insurance, roadway coverage, credit cards, and savings accounts. "We'll have to get it fixed," I said in a disgusted voice. We might have to rent a car and tow it.
Tow it? She screamed. We're over 500 miles away from home.
She pulled out her wallet and began digging through it. She pulled out a driver's license, an insurance certificate, and a roadway assistance card from the neat slots of her billfold.
You know what that would cost, she said.
Could I see those? I asked, taking the cards from her hands and scanning them for information. For accident coverage, they had State Farm, with a $500 deductible and no emergency tow services. Rather than a AAA membership like everyone else in the country has, they had Oldsmobile Roadway Assistance. I checked the paperwork, scanning through the list of 25 provisos, exclusions, and caveats, the most significant of which was the requirement that the car could only be towed by an authorized Oldsmobile dealership to the nearest Olds dealer. Otherwise, claims would not be honored. In this way, it seems, we belonged to General Motors forever. My mother began to pull all the plastic cards in her wallet out, one by one, as if an answer lay there. Her hands were shaking. From the driver's side, I noticed the contents of her wallet. A Social Security card, a lifetime membership in Sam's Club, an Amoco gas card, and a garden variety Master Club. My mind began to reel. In my wallet, stashed on the floor of the back seat, I held my own secret lineup, a Gold Plus AAA card, a Preferred Gold MasterCard, and a Platinum Visa. Forget don't leave home without it. Hello, anywhere you want to be. I knew I could get us home. The only challenge was how quickly and efficiently. By now, the contents of my mother's purse were spilling over her lap as she kicked open the passenger door with her foot, her hankies, lipsticks, and compact rolling onto the pavement.
We need to get some help,
she said, jumping out of the car with her wallet tucked under her arm.
Oh, Violet, my father reached for his windbreaker. Just wait a second.
He slipped his arms into the sleeves. I reached into the back seat and grabbed my coat. The breeze that had seemed so cool and refreshing from the inside of the car was now blowing hard and cold on the outside. By now, my mother was standing on the edge of the highway without a coat, waving her Oldsmobile Roadway Assistance card at passing motorists, as if the sheer sight of it would cause automobiles to go from 90 to 0 in 5 seconds flat. It wasn't working. Cars were switching to the left lane and zooming by to avoid this wild-haired madwoman hanging on the side of the road.
Why won't they help us?
My mother screamed back at us in the wind. From the car, we watched her step into the driving lane and raise her arm again. All the cards from her wallet floated to the pavement.
Violet,
my father said with alarm. He jumped out of the car and rushed up the road to where she stood. I followed behind, collecting the glass, chrome, and fiberglass pieces of our car as I went along.
Get out of the lane, my father screamed, waving his hands at my mother.
He followed behind her, bending to pick up the cards as they blew down the highway.
You're going to get us all killed.
I finally caught up with them. In my arms, I held a good selection of fragments from the Oldsmobile's front end.
Why don't you guys get in the car?
I said, dumping the pieces in a pile near the ditch. I'll stay out here and try to get help.
No!
My mother screamed, a cry raging in her voice.
Why won't they stop and help us?
I could almost hear her thinking, people back home would never act this way. I circled around to the back of the car, picking up more debris, the bent rims and bits of glass from our headlights. I returned and added the pieces to the pile.
They won't stop for all three of us,
my father screamed over the wind. He pulled my mother toward the car. She finally yielded, but not before coming back to hand me the Oldsmobile Roadside Assistance card. As soon as they were inside the car, a beat-up Chevy pickup slowed down, pulled to the side of the road,
then snaked its way toward me in reverse, with its backup lights shining. Inside it were the two guys with baseball caps, who quickly agreed that they would drive to the next town and call the highway patrol. I talked to them for a few minutes, telling them what had happened. I pointed down the road to where I thought the deer had landed. "If you bag it," the one guy asked, "do they let you keep the meat?" He eyed the median where I had pointed, as if he were considering coming back and loading up the carcass himself. "I don't know what they'll do with her," I said, looking down the road. "Maybe they'll feed it to the wolves," the other guy in the baseball cap said. Then I saw my mother open the car door and step out of the passenger side, her white shoe setting down on the pavement. "Don't forget," she leaned on the frame of the open car door and screamed in the wind, "tell them that it has to be a tow truck from an Oldsmobile dealership." After the two guys in baseball caps drove off on their way to make the phone call for us, I knew that we'd have a long wait. I spent the time cleaning up the rest of the debris, running back down the highway about 100 feet, where a few large pieces of fiberglass lay in the middle of the road. Cars hurtled by, sending them flying in smaller pieces. After I gathered them all, I waited for the lanes to clear, then I charged across the road and scanned the median for the deer. I found her lying flat and completely still on her right side, her left eye blankly staring into the sky. I thought about how, for a moment before she disappeared from my view, just as the car had lifted her off the ground, I caught a glimpse of recognition in her eyes, as if she'd always expected that we were out there somewhere, speeding madly by on the edge of her world. I climbed down into the grassy median and bent closer to her. She looked as if she had not moved or struggled in that spot, as if she had been dead when she landed. I hoped that was so. I thought about something a friend told me about the writer Barry Lopez, how he stops when he sees roadkill on the side of the highway, and he kneels beside it to bless the animal and ask for forgiveness. I considered doing it for this creature that I had killed, but found I could not. Something inside me would not say I was sorry. One thing you discover after you hit a deer is that nearly everyone else in the world has, or has almost, hit a deer. And when you try to tell your story to people, they will interrupt you with their own "I hit a deer" stories. Their stories may be more or less dramatic than yours, but they've had more time to formulate the plot, so they will rush ahead in the telling and leave you behind, holding that jumbled collection of details that you have not yet neatened into a story. In this way, for a time, you will go away frustrated from the experience of hitting a deer. That day, after I cleared the debris from the road, I returned to the car and told my parents that I'd found the deer. I assured them that she was dead and that she appeared not to have struggled. "I don't care about the damn deer," my mother said. "All I care about is my car." I turned to look at this woman in the passenger seat. She had smoothed her hair down with a comb and applied a fresh coat of lipstick. It ringed her lips in a bright O. Her purse was reinstalled at her feet, packed up and all in order. For a second, I had the urge to push my fist hard into her mouth, but I did not. We spent 45 minutes sitting in the car, waiting for the highway patrol, repeating the four or five things we knew for sure: how no one saw her coming, and that we'd been very lucky, how it could have turned out much worse, and how it was no one's fault. I found myself wishing that Nick were there. It wouldn't have happened to him. But both my parents made a point of saying they were glad I was the one who had been driving, and that neither of them could have done a better job. Then the highway patrolman arrived. He asked to speak to me alone in the patrol cruiser, since I was the driver. I gave him my parents' insurance certificate and my driver's license. After he called the tow truck and filled out the accident report, he offered to give me a ride to town because the tow truck would only accommodate 2 passengers. My mom and dad agreed to stay with the car. When I got to the Oldsmobile dealership, I knew I had about 30 minutes to devise a plan. I asked Jeff, the shop manager, if I could use a phone. He put me behind a desk, and I got to work, dialing numbers, calling insurance companies, inquiring about rental trucks. My idea was that we would strap the car into a tow dolly behind a rental van or truck and get on the road. We would be home a few hours later than planned, but still, we would get there by evening. I made careful notes and I calculated costs. All told, it came to about $200, a pittance, which I had decided I was going to pay if the trip interruption insurance would not cover it. I did all this in 20 minutes and was beginning to feel quite proud of myself. I was sitting with my feet up on the desk, thinking about a scene in an old movie called The Hawaiians. The film is an adaptation of a James Michener novel, starring Charlton Heston as an imperialist settler of Hawaii, famous for having introduced the pineapple to the island. In the movie, Heston's character becomes hugely wealthy and lives alone with his son in a large plantation-style home. The mother of the boy has been dead for years, her portrait occupying a place of honor above the formal dining table. For the most part, I've forgotten the movie, but there's one scene that's always stayed with me. Near the end of the story, when the son reaches his late teens, he grows restless with being the heir apparent to the pineapple fortune and yearns for true adventure. There are a couple of heated scenes between the boy and the father until Heston, an old seaman himself, realizes the boy needs to test his mettle in the larger world and arranges for his son to set sail as a ship's mate. The next day, seeing the boy off at the pier, the father knocks the kid on the side of the head and says in that Heston voice, "Son, take care of yourself." He grabs the boy's shoulders and stares at him face to face as if he can't believe the boy will soon be a man. "I will, Pa," the boy says obligingly and kicks the dirt. "And if you get into trouble," Heston begins, but then he stops himself. He has all the power and wealth of the world at his disposal. "If you get yourself in trouble," the father begins again, turning away from the boy and starting the long walk down the pier. The camera lingers on the back of his short-cropped riding jacket as he yells, "Well, just get yourself out of it, that's all." The day we hit a deer, I remember looking out the window of the body shop and waiting for my parents to appear in the tow truck. I was anxious to show them all my worldly gifts, the survival skills I had developed since they last knew me as a child. Soon the tow truck pulled into the lot with the Oldsmobile trailing behind. It seemed strange to see the wreck so far from the freeway, trussed up in tow straps and traveling through the city as if on display. "Oh!" Jeff, the body shop manager, winced and stepped away from the plate glass window when he saw the car. "That's bad." My parents climbed down from the tow truck and walked across the parking lot. They looked small to me then, like children getting off a school bus at the end of a day full of pop quizzes and word problems. They came through the door with that beaten look on their faces. I jumped to my feet and introduced them to Jeff. The body shop manager scratched his head and talked to my parents for a while, agreeing that, no, the car sure didn't look like it could be driven home, and adding, "Gee, it sure was strange that a deer was out there on the road at this time of the day." My parents nodded. My father looked at Jeff with glazed eyes. "We didn't even see it coming," he said for the 40th time. "Well, here's the idea I have," I said, sensing the chit-chat was winding down. I stepped out from behind the desk and began to spell out the plan, giving them details and dollar amounts. I could finalize the arrangements within 20 minutes, I told them. Then Jeff would mount the car on the tow dolly, and we'd be down the road. I stopped breathlessly and looked around. "Did I mention," I said, "that I'm willing to pay for all this?" It's not as if I expected them to jump up, clap their hands, and scream, "Oh, goody, goody, goody," like a couple of five-year-olds. What I wanted to see was a sigh of relief, the recognition that the crisis was over. Jeff stood off toward the corner, watching the scene. Then I noticed that my mother was shaking her head, and, in fact, had been shaking her head all along. My father was silent, staring out the window, perhaps not hearing anything I had said. "Oh, mercy, no," my mother said in a wary voice, as if I'd told her some very bad news. "Oh, no," she repeated, her voice soft and wobbly. I then realized that the plan had too many moving parts for her, too many components all strung together. For the plan to be a success, every part had to function properly, and my mother never believed anything complicated would function properly, except sometimes maybe when it did so by accident. Right there in the body shop, she was considering all the worst possible scenarios. What if the car came loose, floating backward on the freeway, causing a 12-car pileup, which would be followed by just as many lawsuits? What if the rental broke down, and then we'd be stuck in some strange town with a broken-down truck and a wrecked car? "Oh, no," my mother repeated. Then she turned and walked toward the telephone. "Let's call Nick," she said to my father. Right now, Nick would be in the fields, feverishly working late into each night, trying to get his crops planted in time to beat the coming rains. "Nick could come and get us," my mother said, her voice lifting. She liked the sound of it already. I looked at Jeff, the body shop manager. Maybe my eyes were saying, "Help me out here," but Jeff didn't answer. He drew a deep breath, raised his finger in the air, and began to move toward the door. "Tell you what," he said, "I'll give you folks a chance to talk in private." I couldn't blame him. Who wouldn't like to be rid of a family and all the hurts and history they carried with them with one simple turn of a doorknob? "Call Nick," I said in disbelief as soon as we were alone. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Every day my father drove out to the farm to hound my brother, quizzing him and cautioning him. "Are you keeping up? How much did that cost? Don't buy that tractor. Stay ahead of the weather. Don't let the bank get a hold of you." And now they were proposing that we pull him out of the field for 2 days during spring planting to come and save us? "We're over 500 miles from home," I said to my mother. It felt good to be the one reminding her of this. It would take him 10 hours just to get here. "We don't have any choice," my mother said. She walked over to the desk, picked up the phone, and dialed my brother's number. "Nick," she said when she got him on the line, "we had a little accident." She paused while Nick said something on the other end. "We're all okay," she said, "but the car is wrecked." And now her voice got high and watery. "And we were wondering," she said, "if you could come and get us." And this is a great place to stop in our reading of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt, a professor and chair of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University. You have been listening to this book on KHOI-FM's Community Bookshelf. Mary Richards, producer, Janet Kloss, assistant producer, and Rick Morrison, chief engineer. You can hear this program every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this time. And to hear prior episodes, visit the Community Bookshelf page on the KHOI website. This is Mary Richards. Thanks for listening.